Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last night, Senate Republicans and Democrats averted another shutdown after striking a deal on disaster relief funding. Steve Inskeep talked about it earlier on NPR's Morning Edition.
In a brutally partisan year, this counts as progress. Congress is closer to avoiding a government shutdown when the fiscal year ends at the end of the week. Republicans and Democrats were tied in knots over a measure to provide disaster funding, as well as fund the broader government. House Republicans refused to provide the disaster funds unless they were offset by spending cuts elsewhere. Democrats wanted the money without strings attached. But yesterday, senators from both parties overwhelmingly approved a deal, meaning that the government stays open all the way from now until mid-November, if the House approves.
So is that what they call compromise? And is that how government used to work all the time? Joining us to talk about that more is NPR's political junkie, political editor, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
So back in the good old days, what is that? I can't remember, Ken.
Well, I think this is a good feeling in Congress that could last at least until maybe 1:30 this afternoon. And this is what it is. And I think this is why America seems to be so tired of this. Basically, after we've always all breathed a sigh of relief earlier this year that the government will function, the government will not shut down, then they would have shut down over disaster relief. That the Republicans said that, as Steve Inskeep pointed out, that it has to be offset by spending cuts. The Democrats said that this is nonsense, people are suffering. And so the only thing that happened yesterday was that the Senate, by a lopsided margin, agreed that there would be less money for disaster relief to satisfy the Republicans, and there would be no spending cuts to satisfy the Democrats. But we still have to wait for what the House has to say about it. But again, so this, you know, assuming this happens, it funds the government all the way until November 18th. And then we start all over again.
So right.
I don't know what the solution is, and I don't know how it changes, and it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. And of course, you know, everybody's in their election mode, but it seems like everybody is always in their election mode.
I'm trying to figure out, in this particular case, how less disaster relief helps Republicans. Is that something they run around bragging about?
Well, you know something, of course, it depends on who you talk to, but I try to be really fair about this. You always see the good sides and the bad sides of both positions.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see how Republicans, given the flooding, the unbelievable forces of nature that we've been seeing the last couple of months, this whole year, in fact, with earthquakes and flooding and hurricanes and everything, and for the absolutists to say, well, you know, this is not what government should do, and if it does do it, we have to offset the cuts elsewhere. It seems heartless. I'm trying to be very fair and try to see this from both sides, but it just seems very heartless, and I don't know how it's a winning Republican issue.
Yeah, I thought if it was coupled with spending cuts elsewhere, that might play somewhere. But just saying we cut disaster relief, period, I don't know.
But even so, I mean, if people are suffering, I mean, you know,
right.
I understand that the government is out of control. And yes, I understand that, you know, the Tea Party members were elected in 2010 because they were tired of politics as usual. They were tired of the way that we would just keep, you know, spending and spending and spending and let our great, you know, grandchildren worry about it. But in a case like this, you know, we're not talking about a ton of money, you know, theoretically. And I don't know, everything shouldn't be looked at in terms of politics. But if this is looked at in terms of politics, I don't see how the Republicans benefit.
So now what happens in mid-November when we're supposed to shut down again?
We'll go
or
through the
could
whole thing.
Shut down.
Well, that's what happens. Once again, we'll have to have more spending cuts than the Democrats would like. And, of course, when the Democrats would ask for a corresponding rise in the tax of millionaires, Republicans say that's off the table. So they're no closer to seeing eye to eye or any kind of accommodation than they have been, you know, all year long.
So who should take credit for this compromise such as it is now?
I don't think anybody's taking credit, actually. I kind of think people are saying that, we dodged another bullet.
Okay.
And people will benefit. But I don't think anybody's, you know, pumping their chest saying that we saved the American people.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie and political editor. If you have a question or comment for Ken, we welcome them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We just posted it on Facebook again, so if you want to go there and post your question or comment, we welcome that on the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page. Saturday Night Live opened its 37th season last week with a satire of the latest GOP presidential debate. And in this clip that we're going to listen to, Alec Baldwin plays Texas Governor Rick Perry and Bill Hader plays moderator and Fox News anchor Shepard Smith.
Ship of a man, I'd like to attack Mitt Romney as a flip-flopper.
You sure it's late in the debate? This is when you normally get tired and confused.
Well, not tonight. Yeah, I'm ready. Mitt Romney said he was for, against Obamacare. But what about Mitt Romney? I mean, Mitt Romney care. Was it was before he was before?
Well, you know, I don't know if this translates well in audio as it did in video, but I mean, as funny as the Saturday Night Live presentation was, and everybody was hysterical, you have to see Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain. We'll talk about Herman Cain in a second.
Right.
By the way, Herman Cain, the next nominee, in a second. But the thing, what was so remarkable is that really Rick Perry, I have never seen somebody come into the race so late. I mean, maybe Fred Thompson similarly 4 years ago, but Rick Perry not only came into the race very, very late, he came in with such a flourish that he was the front runner, that all the talk about Michelle Bachmann and all the so-called gains she made after winning the Iowa straw poll, all the strengths that Mitt Romney ostensibly had, that all went by the wayside when Rick Perry got into the race. And now we've seen three successive debates in which Mitt Romney has gotten progressively worse. And you think...
You mean Rick Perry.
What did I say?
You said Mitt Romney.
I did it again.
Yeah, that's okay.
I'm sorry. No, Rick Perry has done exceedingly worse. His numbers, his answers are not clear. His facts are jumbled. And the one ideological statement he made the other day saying that children of illegal immigrants should pay you know, regular tuition prices to go to school in Texas, and that the building the border, the border fence is idiocy. Now, that may make complete sense in a state like Texas, but after all, this is a Republican primary for president, and talking about illegal aliens and mocking a fence between the U.S. And Mexico is not smart politics. I mean, it could be right politics, but it's certainly not smart politics if he wants to win over a conservative base.
Early on, he was criticized, or people questioned his readiness for a race like this, given he didn't have much of a foreign policy repertoire. He didn't really have that much national experience.
Well, of course, no governor, unless you talk about John Huntsman, who not only served as governor of Utah but served as ambassador to China, no governor really has an expertise in foreign policy, although I thought it was very interesting when Rick Perry attacked Henry Winkler for starting a Fonzi scheme, and I didn't know why he did that at all, but I thought I'd throw that joke in. You know, the Fonzi was the... Yeah.
Well, at least he didn't say he could see Mexico from his backyard.
Well, you know something, I mean, that it reminds people, first of all, in fairness to the whole system, I mean, Sarah Palin was chosen. Sarah Palin didn't run for president on her expertise. She was chosen. She was thrown into this thing at the last second, and I don't think she was prepared at all. But how could you expect her to be prepared when you know, right before she was chosen, she was not boning up on foreign policy or anything? But but Rick Perry, one would think, given the amount of money he's been raising, given the fact that conservatives have been pining for somebody other than Mitt Romney. See, I said Mitt Romney correctly this time. And yet he comes in, and in my opinion, I watched the last three debates. I thought Perry was a complete bust.
You weren't alone, I guess, because there's that straw poll in Florida.
Well, I don't know what to make of that at all.
Herman Cain.
And we always talk about less so what straw polls mean for the winner, and I think more so what they mean for the loser.
Right.
And so the big headlines, of course, in Iowa last month, was it only last month?
Yeah.
But last month when Michelle Bachmann took the political world by storm by winning the straw poll, everybody said, wow, that's pretty neat. And Ron Paul finished a very close second, and everybody said, well, who cares, because Ron Paul always wins straw polls, so that was dismissed. But Tim Pawlenty finished a poor third, and boom, he was gone for the race the next day. He didn't even survive to make it to the caucuses or the primaries in 2012. I mean, just a couple of thousand people said that, well, you know, Tim Pawlenty is not the guy, and he was gone. And once upon a time, he was going to be the alternative to Mitt Romney. So here we have another straw poll. Rick Perry spends a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort to wooing these delegates. And who wins it? The former CEO of Godfather Pizza. I mean, that's just remarkable. I mean, Herman Cain does give a very impassioned speech. He's seen as a good guy. I don't think he has the smartest, you know, I don't think he has the most well-thought-out plans in the world. Of course, a few weeks ago, he made headlines by saying he would not appoint a Muslim to his cabinet, which is always, you know, smart politics. But he just, you know, I mean, first of all, you know, I don't even know if the country is ready for a black president. No, that's silly.
But doesn't work anymore.
No, I used that joke once before. But I mean, Herman Cain, he has no organization. He has no money. He is a crowd pleaser. He does get folks on their feet. But let's be honest here. This is not American Idol, and this is not America Got Talent. It's the next president of the United States, and I'm not, you know, I mean, Herman Cain could be a nice guy, but the next president of the United States, the next Republican nominee for president, well, I'm sure the Obama administration would be very happy with that, but I don't know if the American people would.
So what are the values of the straw polls? Is it more important in Iowa than it is in Florida, Ohio? It looks like the Republicans in Ohio want to have a straw poll now in November, in late October. They admittedly said they want to do it just to attract candidates to the state, but in any event.
And that's what it does. I mean, I certainly a lot of people were breathlessly talking about the straw poll as they were breathlessly talking about the Iowa straw poll for 6 months. And for all the victory, you know, for all the headlines that Michelle Bachmann got for winning it, who talks about Michelle Bachmann anymore?
Yeah,
only a month later.
But that's shocking. What Rick Perry eclipsed her that completely?
He did, and I was surprised at that, too. First of all, he also appeals to the Tea Party base. Michelle Bachmann has had a history of saying, you know, some gaffes that she wished she could have taken back. Of course, when she talked about Lexington and Concord being in New Hampshire and not Massachusetts. I mean, you know, when you're the head of the Tea Party caucus and you forget about where the American Revolution took place, that's not an encouraging sign. But having said that, you know, I just think they feel that with Rick Perry, with his bombast, with his, you know, 10 years as governor of Texas, with his, you know, demolishing Democratic candidates in the past, he would be the guy. But, I mean, for all the faults that Mitt Romney has, I still see Mitt Romney as a much stronger general election candidate in November than Rick Perry. But the question is, do you want to go with somebody? The question for Republicans is, do you want to go for somebody who could beat the President Obama, or do you want somebody who's truer to your ideological heart? And if the latter is the case, then for the longest time, Rick Perry was the guy.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for him, we'll get to them as soon as we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland. Congratulations to the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio and for winning recognition for outstanding coverage of Ohio's economy.
Where do you find a job in Wilmington today?
It's hard to. There's no places to find a job.
Ohio unemployment still at nearly 10% and job growth slow at best.
Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, 57 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a high of 71. There is a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 51 degrees. Rain is likely on Wednesday, a high of 67, and some more rain for Wednesday night, a low of 52. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
We're talking politics with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a few comments. I just watched the documentary Inside Job this weekend, and I would suggest all listeners get that and watch it. And I don't see how anybody who watched that documentary could vote for a Republican or a Democrat. The lobbyists are taking over, and I would also suggest that people look into Americans Elect, and I would like to hear what the gentleman has to say about that. Thank
Ken?
You.
Yep. Thanks,
well,
Mark.
Mark, good question. Americans Elect is this group that basically is trying to get a ballot, get on the ballot in 50 states through an internet convention, and offer an alternative to the Democrats and Republicans, to President Obama and the Republican nominee. I think this is an understandably popular, in some respects, effort. I think it's doomed to failure. First of all, they don't even have a candidate. It's one thing to say that, we don't like the D's and we don't like the R's and they're both corrupt and they're both part of this corporate elite and therefore we have to go for somebody else. But one, they don't have a candidate. And two, in the past when we have had a candidate who represents neither the D's nor the R's, the results are terrible. Ross Perot was a perfect example. The economy was really, really bad in 1992. Bill Clinton, the Democrat, had tons of flaws. President Bush was shown unable to deal with the economy. Here comes Ross Perot, $60 million of his own money, $60 million of his own money. He got 19 million votes, more votes than any other third-party candidate in history. And how many electoral votes did he get? Zero. You need 270 electoral votes to be elected president. He fell 270 short. He finished twice, second in only two states, didn't carry any state. And the question is the American public upset and angry and frustrated with what's going on? Absolutely. But somehow, I don't know if it's because of the media, I don't know if it's because of debates, but the point is we just seem to be so rooted in a two-party system that every time somebody else comes along, be it a George Wallace or a John Anderson or a Ralph Nader or a Ross Perot, they get a lot of boost when they're first talking about their candidacy, but as we get closer to October and November, voters don't vote for them.
And people end up calling them spoilers if they do make any headway?
Well, look, Ralph Nader's got 2% of the vote in 2000, which seems like nothing, but the fact that it is he got 97,000 votes in Florida, and if Al Gore lost to George W. Bush by only 537 votes, many people think that much of the 97,000 votes Gore got, Nader got, mm-hmm. could have gone to Al Gore. So a lot of that people talk about spoilers. Who did Ross Perot hurt? Who did John Anderson hurt? Nobody talks about them as potential winners. Now, Americans Elect, the group that Mark talks about, says this is different, that the stakes are higher than ever, that the situation is worse than ever, and it may be good argument for that, but until I see who this candidate is, nobody named none of the above has ever been elected president.
One of the things that the third-party candidates, such as they are or whoever they are, they get people involved often in politics who usually maybe don't even vote.
Well, that's true. We did see that a lot. And, first of all, and with Ross Perot, a lot of people who just discussed it came out and vote. A lot of people who Barack Obama attracted, mm-hmm. a lot of disaffected youth came out and vote. And that's part of the problem with Obama, that he had so much hope. We use that word over and over again, so much promise in 2008. And, 3 years later, we have 9.1% unemployment. We have 16 million people out of work. A lot of that optimism and hope has gone out the window. So, again, the idea, the thought of an alternative is great. Show me who the candidate is, and then maybe we could talk about it.
Speaking of Obama, it was reported that a lot of his small donations are way down from 2008. He's not attracting those kind of marginal people who can, give a little here, give a little there. It might be the economy might be part of it, but...
It's a big part of it. And as I said, a lot of the enthusiasm is down. Mm-hmm. I mean, earlier, maybe last year, we were all talking about the first $1 billion campaign in history. Barack Obama was likely to raise $1 billion. I mean, I mean, I don't make that in 5 years at NPR. So it's, you know, it's, I mean, that's a lot of money. So, but, and I still think he will far outspend and outraise the Republicans, even though they do have these American Crossroads and these other groups, thanks to the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that will allow a lot of under the cover, under the table money being raised by the Republicans. I still think Obama will be raising the most, but again, you can have all the money in the world, you know, as you want. Ross Perot had the $60 million and everything. But if the enthusiasm gap is there, if the people who came out in 2008 saying, I don't know if I want to get involved like I did 4 years ago, that could really be the one that dooms him. If Barack Obama, if this is a referendum on Barack Obama, he's in big, big trouble. What the Democrats have to hope for is that it's a choice between Barack Obama and whoever the Democrat, the Republicans put up, and then the Obama thing perhaps will be in better standing.
We have an email from Angel. She writes, "Why don't the Democrats have groups like the Tea Party? I sort of felt Howard Dean had a following like the Tea Party, but we know how that ended."
Well, it yes, and the thing is, for a while, the so-called net roots. That Howard Dean performed so, you know, did so well with in 2003. I mean, everybody blamed the Scream for how Howard Dean's collapse. That's not what it was. I think a lot of Democrats felt that he was not the guy who was going to beat George W. Bush. It was John Kerry who was going to beat George W. Bush. But for the longest time, we talked about the net roots, the internet, but. You know, we tried Air America. That didn't work. We know that a lot of the left looks to MSNBC for a possible rallying cry, but I don't know what it is. The right wing seems to have control of talk radio. They said Fox News is by far the most popular cable show on television. It's not even close. And I don't know why it is, because, you know, I always thought that once, if Bill Clinton is unpopular, if Barack Obama is unpopular, the right wing gets very energized. But even when George W. Bush was unpopular, the left didn't seem to have the kind of fervor that the conservatives do today. And you know, so I think the best hope for the Democratic left is to have a Republican president. Otherwise, it's hard to run on the defensive. You know, it's hard to say that. Well, Barack Obama isn't terrible, but he's certainly better than the other guys. That's not a good campaign slogan.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you all. I only have one question. I think the time has come for us to abolish the Electoral College and go for mass vote by the people, and I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Thanks, Mary.
Well, what Mary's saying has been argued for a long, long time, and of course it was never more so argued than in 2000 when Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush, and yet because he didn't have an Electoral College majority, didn't get elected president. That's only happened, I think, three times in the past in history, but it was very visible with the fact that Gore won by 400,000 or 500,000 votes and didn't get the presidency. The thing is, to do that, you have to have a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College and do a popular vote. And the small states, you know, if we just do the popular vote, everybody will campaign in Ohio and Texas and Florida and New York and California, and all the smaller states will be completely ignored. The fact is, so many candidates go into states like New Mexico, which is small, or New Hampshire, which is small, or Colorado, which is relatively small, because they're considered swing states. So the small states know that if we abolish the Electoral College and we had a popular vote, we know that the small states would lose out completely. And so the delegations in Congress, when they vote on a constitutional amendment, that would never, ever pass. One alternative to the Electoral College is the thought of what right now Maine and Nebraska do, and they allocate their votes by proportional, by congressional district. If you win a congressional district in your state, like Ohio will have 16 districts, you win it, you know, it goes, whoever wins the district gets an electoral vote, plus two votes for winning the state. The problem is that Pennsylvania is trying that now, and Pennsylvania, of course, is a pretty relatively secure Democratic state. And, if one state does it, you want every state to do it. You don't just want Democratic states with Republicans in charge to suddenly change the name of the game and then help the Republicans in the middle of the, middle of the game.
Why can they do it differently? They can change the game a little bit, but you have to do a constitutional amendment to eliminate the Electoral College.
Well,
how does that work?
Well, Pennsylvania is not Pennsylvania would not the position the so-called scheme that's in Pennsylvania right now. They're not trying to eliminate the Electoral College. They're just doing the allocation of Electoral College votes.
Okay, so states can decide how that works.
Yes, and already, as I said, Maine and Nebraska already have that. But of course, Maine and Nebraska are not about to. I mean, Maine has 4 electoral votes, and Nebraska has 5 electoral votes. They're not about to change the winner and loser. But when you have a state like Pennsylvania, I mean, that could very well determine, whether Obama gets reelected or not.
President Obama visited Ohio twice so far this month, giving speeches in Columbus and Cincinnati to promote his jobs bill. And in Columbus, he spoke recently. Let's hear what he had to say.
Well, you got to make sure that everybody pays their fair share, including the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations.
He urged the crowd to call their congressmen and demand they support the bill. He's been here twice this month already. Is this just early on that they pay a lot of attention to Ohio, or do we know where we're falling in the importance category?
Oh, there's no question that Ohio is one of the key. I mean, going back to the Electoral College argument, there's no question the importance of Ohio. It's still a swing state. President Obama won it by 5 percentage points in 2008. A lot of people feel that he'd be very lucky to do that well in 2012. I mean, the argument that we've already said that, 4 years earlier, had John Kerry received 80,000 more votes in Ohio, he would have been the president. Ohio is one of those states, like Florida, that, could very well determine the next president of the United States, as it did in 2004. So he knows what's ahead of him. He knows that unemployment is on the rise. He knows that we were talking about how passive he's been for so long, how equal, even tempered he's been. Now he's really saying, look, that's not working. My offer to compromise is not working. It's now time to go on the attack and just, lay it out there. Two problems, of course, the Republicans will call it class warfare. There is probably some truth to the fact that it is pitting class against class, but basically the American public feels that, the fact that millionaires pay far less in taxes than the regular people, that's just not fair. The problem, of course, is that he's also pushing this jobs bill, this $447 billion jobs bill, that many of his own fellow Democrats are not crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to go around the country saying, the Republicans are obstructionists, you got to pass this bill. Well, he said, pass this bill now. Well, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, is in no rush to bring this for a vote. Again, there are a lot of nervous Democrats out there. So is this the 2012 campaign? Absolutely. Should this be the 2012 campaign? Sure, because I think this is what the Democrats want to let the American people know, that this is the difference between the two parties.
When you're throwing something out there, if it's for the 2012 campaign, what if it fails?
If the bill fails?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it. Well, first of all, it will fail. And the reason it will fail is because it's calling for, taxing millionaires. And John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, and Republicans left and right, or right and right, have said that this is not absolutely a non-starter. It's not going to happen. So it's not going to pass. But if the American people feel that this, this tax fairness is a key issue, and that it's wrong for millionaires not to be paying, given the dire circumstances of the economy in this country, basically what he's doing is that, let them go past the Congress, and then go straight to the people.
614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to talk to Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. We had an earlier Facebook post from someone, Ken, who wondered, are we doomed?
Well, WOSU or the Ann Fisher?
I think the entire nation.
Oh, are we? look, am I encouraged? Am I optimistic? I'm not. I don't know how Congress changes. I don't know. I mean, unless there's going to be an uprising by the American people, and you know, and that goes back to the early call about, you know, Americans elect and whether that's the alternative. But it just doesn't work. And the fact is, it was such a traumatic thing earlier this year about the possibility of America, the U.S., you know, defaulting and the government shutting down, and we all breathed a sigh of relief, and that's not going to happen. And then here we go on this disaster relief that here's going to happen all over again. And who knows what happens on November 18th when we have to start this thing all over again. It's not encouraging. First of all, there's no way that unemployment numbers are going to come down drastically in time to benefit President Obama in 2012. And so the blame game will continue. The bickering on Capitol Hill will begin. Will continue. And you just wonder if voters around the country saying this is just insanity.
President Obama angered some of his most loyal supporters in a recent speech to the Congressional Black Caucus, and he talked about his accomplishments and, you know, what call for passage of his jobs bill, which he's been doing regularly, as we said. He also gave some marching orders. He said, "I expect all of you to march with me and press on. Take off your bedroom slippers, put on your marching shoes, shake it off. Stop complaining, stop grumbling, stop crying. We are going to press on. We've got work to do, CBC." They applauded, but the reverberations from that have not been very positive.
Well, you know, some people are saying it's plantation politics, and the fact is the African-American community is clearly President Obama's strongest base. It was incredibly loyal in 2008, justifiably so, in the primaries and in the general election. And they feel that, look, you know, when people are out of work, when unemployment numbers are rising, who are suffering the most? African Americans are suffering the most proportionally. And so Maxine Waters and other black members of Congress are saying, you know, give us a break here. And Obama being the professorial, you know, even-keeled kind of guy he is, he said, look, we're all in this together. Stop carping because, you know, we're all in this fight together. But I don't know if that works. You know, I don't know if this works.
Well, they say he doesn't say it to other constituencies. He doesn't tell them to shut up.
No, he doesn't. As a matter of fact, when David Axelrod was asked a few weeks ago about, you know, this kind of complaint, he said, look, Barack Obama is president of all the people, not just, you know, the African-American community. And of course that's true, but it also sounds, I don't know if it sounds patronizing or condescending or just insulting, but, you know, sometimes when, you know, there's more at stake, there's more on the line for the black community, especially since the 2008 election. And to be said, look, you know, I'm your only good alternative. Stop carping. I could see a lot of grumbling coming out of that.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. When we return, we'll continue our conversation and we'll get to some of your calls. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Bowden tells us how the Conficker worm penetrated the operating systems of millions of computers worldwide, linking them together into a powerful supercomputer that can be remotely controlled by Conficker's creators. Bowden is the author of Worm, The First Digital World War. He also wrote Black Hawk Down. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay with us in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of civility in politics in a difficult economy. That discussion begins later this morning at 11. And be sure to visit WOSU.org/allsides for the latest updates from All Sides with Ann Fisher. From our show's website, you can listen and watch the show live every day from 10 until noon. You can also explore the All Sides archive, which includes audio and video of every show. That's WOSU.org/allsides. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 71 degrees. There is a chance of rain tonight and a low of 51. Rain is likely for Wednesday, a high of 67, and a chance of rain Wednesday night, a low of 52. Looking ahead to Thursday, there's a chance of afternoon rain and some sunshine, a high near 70 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking politics with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, and email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a Facebook message from Sean. He says, I would love to hear Ken's comments on the framing wars. The GOP seems to do a much better job of pitching their platforms to appeal to voters' values. Why does the Democratic Party do such a poor job of that, and how can they turn it around? I have a hunch that the Dems spend too much time intellectualizing issues. Are today's voters capable of responding to anything beyond emotional appeals? A lot of questions there, but kind of about the same thing.
Well, I think certainly he's right, but it's easy to do that when you're angry and energized, and it's more difficult to do it when you're on the defensive. I thought that in 2006 and 2008, the Democrats did a far better job of identifying the issues. I mean, I remember in 2006, a whole bunch of Democratic members of the Senate would stand outside of a gas station and point to the $4 and plus gas prices. I mean, because you know, between or among Katrina and the gas prices and the food prices and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the unpopularity of President Bush, the Democrats seemed to have the messages because they had the issues on their side. And then when you have, you know, an uncertain, if not faltering, economy, if you have, you know, more and more people just unable to get work or having given up finding jobs because they don't exist, then the Republicans are better able to frame the issue. So I don't think it's the Republicans are more capable of doing this, even though they seem to be far more united than the Democrats are. In other words, there's no such thing. We talk about the Democratic blue dogs. There's no liberal, you know, component of the Republican Party to compare to that. But I also think it's the fact that under a Democratic president, Republicans seem to have their mojo working. But Ann, I also noticed that you said something later. Later in the show, there's going to be a thing on civility and politics.
Next hour, we're talking about civility and democracy.
Is this a comedy segment or this is serious stuff?
This is really serious stuff.
I'm curious. Just...
Jim Leach, a former congressman, you know him.
Right, from Iowa.
Yep. Now the National Endowment for the Humanities, now the chairman of that.
He's always been the kind of guy who believes in talking across the aisle and in civility and not making everything personal. But, you know, Jim Leach, even though he's not been out of Congress for that long,
no,
it seems like it's a lifetime ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, there aren't very many people like him in Congress anymore.
Certainly not on the Republican side.
Exactly. No. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jen in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jen.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a two-part question. The first part is, isn't it true that the American deficit was run up under the Republican administration? And if so, how is it that the Republicans are getting away with blaming it essentially on the Democrats and particularly Barack Obama?
Two part questions. That's the same thing. Well, no, that's a very fair question. There's no question, and President Obama has said this since January 20th, 2009, that he inherited a tremendous mess, that the economy was in a free fall, that some people were equating it to the possibility of another depression. We saw the collapse of Wall Street. There's no question that he came into office and the economy was really, really in trouble, and he did whatever he thought was right to try to reverse it with the big stimulus packages, with the bailouts, things like that. That's all true, and I think for the most part, many people do blame his predecessors for the situation we're in. But having said that, in the third year of presidency, when unemployment has gone up, when the debt has gone up, when somebody who came into office with such hope and such promise, and everybody was saying, this is going to be great, everybody's going to have a job, we're going to be out of Guantanamo, the wars will be over, everybody will get free candy and wax lips, and we'll have free elevator passes in schools. I mean, everything was supposed to be great. The fact that it didn't, I think the fact is he built our expectations and hopes up to such a high level, and the fact that he didn't deliver, perhaps because of a recalcitrant Congress, whatever the reason was, he didn't deliver after 3 years of a presidency, just like with Ted Strickland. I mean, did Ted Strickland have problems when he came into governorship? Sure. But after 3 years, you own it. You own the wars. You own the economy. That's simple, the way I'm putting it. But in politics, perception is reality. And if you're in office for 3 years, and my life has not gotten better in the past 3 years, you blame the incumbent party.
Thank you, Jen, for the call.
That's an important question, though. I think it's a very important question. And I think my answer was very good.
Excellent.
I'm very pleased with my answer.
Let's see what John thinks. John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Morning,
John, let me, John, you got to hold, you can't hold the cell phone too close to your mouth.
Oh, okay.
That yeah, it's a lot better.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I think there's a misperception out there, and I just want to clear it up. On earned income, people with substantial incomes, millionaires, pay a 35% income tax rate, and there's 47% of the people who pay no income tax because their income is so low. There's different kinds of income that isn't taxed equally. And that's what Warren Buffett's got going for him. But let's not say that millionaires pay a lower tax rate.
No, that's true. That's fair. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good deal. Thank you.
Thanks, John. That wasn't so bad.
No, I like John.
Yeah, John's good. Even in a car, we're usually a little hesitant. But Delbert, you're in a car too. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Delbert.
Hey, how are you? I was wondering that I believe that the president's approval rating is down. Low, not because of what he actually does on his job, but because of the spin machine behind the Republican Party. Now, he came in, like they said, am I still there?
Yep.
Okay. So he came in under truly a bad economic situation. But as he tried to turn things around on every corner and every turn that the Republicans fought him, he's not able to pass anything. And speaking as a black man, and I don't understand why the black caucus is so upset. What did they think that he could just, you know, do anything do everything that the black Americans want just with the stroke of a pen? Well, he can't do that. And we have to sit back and wait. And what we need to do, and what all Americans need to do, is give him a second term, because he is truly the only grown up in the room.
Well, okay. I'm not going to dismiss Delbert's point that he's a grown-up because it seems like for much of his term, he has sent out an olive branch that many Republicans have rejected for reasons one after the other. But again, as I said, to give somebody a second term because he means well, or because it can't happen overnight or by the stroke of a pen, there's truth to that. A lot of it is cyclical. A lot of it is just, look, it's a world economy that we're all suffering in. It's not just the U.S. Look what's happening in Greece. Look what's happening in Europe. So it's everywhere that's happening. But again, if you're a voter and you don't understand the things the way Delbert does, and Delbert is right in many of the ways, but all I know is that I've lost my job. My family income is down, and my prospects for a job are not good. How do you vote for another term? I understand African Americans will say, well, look, this is the reason. Obama certainly is more sympathetic to our views than any Republican candidate. But at the same time, if all these things, if you do all this checkoff list, and my situation, as Ronald Reagan once said, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? If the answer is no, then you just vote for an alternative. Look, a lot of the same people who voted in the Democrats for Congress in 2006 and Obama in 2008, a lot of the same people voted for Republicans in 2010 because they hated, they were disappointed with the Republicans in 2006 and 2008, so they figured to give the Democrats a chance, and if their lives have not improved, now they'll give Republicans a chance. This is exactly what politics is all about. Now, I'm not saying what fairness is all about, I'm saying what politics is all about.
Thanks, Delbert, for that call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Ed in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi,
Ed.
My name is Edward Concepcion, and I think, yes, we can bring our communities across the United States to the 21st century, getting rid of traffic jams while creating jobs and revenue all across America.
So you support the president's jobs bill?
I don't know about how hard it's been doing, but I think we, the people, can take the reins and make it better for all of us.
Okay. Thank you, Ed in Reynoldsburg. Ken?
Yeah, I mean, you know, lots of luck. I think it's great. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how, if you have a president who believes in X, Y, and Z, and you have Republicans in Congress who believe A, B, and C, and they're nowhere close to each other on the alphabet, I don't know how you get things done. I don't know how you take things in your own hands unless, and I'm going back to that early caller again, we just say that pox on both their houses and you vote for a third party. But tell me who this third party is, Donald Trump? I mean, you know,
I didn't bring up his name.
No. But I mean, people keep saying that Donald Trump could save America, but I mean, who's going to save us from Donald Trump?
Well, speaking of Donald Trump, what do you make of his meeting with Mitt Romney? They were kind of fussing over it yesterday.
Well, they were fussing over it because Romney snuck out of a back. He was supposed to come out of a certain room and meet with the press, and he snuck out a back entrance, back exit. I don't understand. I've never understood the fixation on Donald Trump as somebody who is a political leader. He's a TV something, whatever he does, and he likes ratings and he likes attention. And I don't see where that gets you anywhere. And even with the Republican base, I don't think anybody, I mean, very few people ever thought of Donald Trump as a serious candidate. So the thought that he's still in this conversation is just a little baffling to me.
We have an email from John. He asks, says, please ask your guest to talk about how D.C. is courting/grooming Ohio Democrats, specifically Youngstown Mayor Jay Williams as the car czar and Richard Cordray as the director of consumer financial protection.
Well, I know very little about the first. I know about Cordray as a second. And, you know, the funny thing is Elizabeth Warren, of course, was the original Obama choice to head up this consumer protection agency. And Obama never nominated her because the Republicans made it clear that they were not going to just let the nomination go forward. And so everybody said, oh, this is really a rejection of Elizabeth Warren. But I think it's even more than that, because Cordray may be in the same kind of boat. I mean, he may not be as hostile to the banks and to the conservatives and to the business establishment that Elizabeth Warren seemed to be. Elizabeth Warren, who, of course, is now running for the Senate in Massachusetts against Scott Brown. But I'm not convinced that Cordray gets a vote either. It's just, again, that's part of the poisonous atmosphere in Washington. But, you know, I'd be surprised if his nomination sails through.
What do you make of Ohio's new congressional redistricting map? Creates 16 districts out of the former 18. It had to. The Republicans designed the map. Well, their map actually creates a new Democratic district centered in Columbus, where we're at. But and former Congresswoman Mary Jo Kilroy has already announced she'll run for the seat. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, to the victor goes the spoilers. And everybody, you know, we always focus on what's important, you know, who will be elected senator and who will be elected congressman. Well, who has been elected governor and who, and where the state legislature goes is so crucial. And we've seen this in states very close to each other. Ohio, which is completely Republican-dominated with the General Assembly, with Governor Kasich, they draw the line. They decide who survives and who doesn't. Next door in Illinois, the Democrats control everything. And just briefly on Illinois, there are, like, I think, 11... No, I'm sorry. There are 8 Republicans in the legislation there, and they basically eliminated or about to eliminate 6 of them. So, you know, you can't say, well, how dare those Republicans in Ohio be so cruel by passing their map in Ohio when Democrats are doing the same thing in Illinois. For the most part, most states, if you control the powers of government, this is what to the victors go the spoils. Now, I don't think the Republicans were that egregious in Ohio, and the reason I say that is because they didn't really have much choice. They already controlled 13 out of the 18. They're going to lose 2 seats. So rather than try to weaken a lot of Democrats, and they have, but I'll get to that in a second, they basically try to firm up the vulnerable Republicans. So what they did by creating this new Democratic district in Columbus, and perhaps Mary Jo Kilroy will run, I mean, I've heard I mean, I don't know if Michael Coleman wants to run, Jennifer Brunner. I've heard other names thrown out there, but Mary Jo Kilroy is in the race. Everybody says, well, you know, that was very nice of the Republicans to give a new Democratic district in Columbus, but at the same time, you know, Tyberry is firmed up. Steve Stivers is firmed up. They've put Marcy Kaptur and Dennis Kucinich in the same district, and I don't think they care who wins or loses. But at the same time, they also put Steve Austria and Mike Turner in the same district around Dayton. So it's not the perfect, and Betty Sutton is in big trouble too, you know, in her district. So it looks like, I mean, right now it's 13 Republicans, 5 Democrats. It could very well be, you know, 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. So the Republicans will not gain that much, even though they gained a lot in 2010. Excuse me. What they will do, and what they intend to do, is firm up the Republicans who were first elected.
One thing they did to John Boehner's district is put it into with the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It's, I guess, the biggest recipient of federal funding for the state.
I didn't know that, but, you know, it's interesting that, I mean, this is true about so many congressmen, that this federal spending is just, you know, really terrible unless it's in your district.
Exactly.
But it's kind of interesting. But they really, I mean, they really did, you know, it's very, look, obviously one Democrat will lose between Kaptur and Kucinich. It looks like Sutton is going to lose as well. You know, if you're losing two districts in Ohio and you're a Republican and you control everything, it's not a surprise that the Democrats are going to take the brunt of the defeats.
Well, Ken Rudin, we didn't get to everything today. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I appreciate the time you spent with us.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and political junkie. Thanks for all your calls and your emails. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.